From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, one of NPR's founders, Bill Siemering, explains what attracted him to public radio more than a half century ago and why it still attracts him.
Well, simply put, I guess every time I turn on public radio, I learn something new. I always think of radio as a source of information and of extraordinary intimacy at times.
Essayist Art Sear puts the recent royal wedding into a larger context.
Radio Chipstone visits a metalsmith to learn who's boss in the creative process.
I cannot impose my will on the metal. It imposes its will on me. It tells me what it wants to be. As I'm working it, as I'm hammering it, even though I may have an idea in mind, it does what it wants to do in the end.
And we'll have the latest in our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next, after the news. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. The Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 paved the way for the creation of National Public Radio. It formally began on February 26, 1970. NPR has come a long way since its earliest days, moving from a time when it was seen as alternative and experimental to the point today where it boasts the most listened to morning show in the United States.
Bill Siemering knows the early days well. The Wisconsin native was one of the guiding forces behind National Public Radio, serving on its founding board. And he later helped develop signature shows such as All Things Considered and Fresh Air. After decades in public radio, he shifted his focus to radio in the developing world, earning a MacArthur Fellowship in his efforts. Siemering was in Milwaukee not long ago, and he joined us in the studio to share some radio history. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure to be with you, Mitch.
Why was radio first important to you?
It was first important to me as a first grader going to a two-room country school outside of Madison, Wisconsin, and listening to the Wisconsin School of the Air. So I learned science, social studies, nature studies, music, art, all by radio. From that time on, I've been fascinated by radio.
Do you still have the memory of those voices coming through the radio from—
I do. Yeah. I do. And interestingly enough, the teacher would always have a manual and know what science things she had to have set up or art things. So a number of them were women, which I realized later was not common in broadcasting. It was a wonderful way to enrich education in a country school.
Right. The country school never would have had access to all these kinds of lessons otherwise.
Exactly. I mean, the teacher was teaching three grades. Which is enough.
Well, how did that work? At a certain time during the day, the teacher would just turn on the radio.
Right. Twice a day, she'd turn it on, and she knew what was coming. And we would listen attentively and do whatever we were told to do.
So when you think about that time and how radio shaped you as a first grader, what of that time still shapes the way you see how radio meets its listeners today?
Well, simply put, I guess every time I turn on public radio, I learn something new. I always think of radio as a source of information and of extraordinary intimacy at times. It's the most intimate medium, really, because it's a human voice. And people are free to engage with a host and open up in ways that they wouldn't in any other way. Television is not conducive to that with the lights and cameras and everything going on. So radio and the listeners are creating the images. Listeners are imagining what you and I look like now. And it's nothing like what we do look like, of course.
Well, and it's funny, even today, for as long as I've been in radio, and I imagine maybe the same for you, I still, to this day, get the images wrong in my head.
Uh-huh. Right. But I think that's part of the ownership the listener has with us, that they're imagining this.
And it goes without saying that we are both tall and very handsome. So there was obviously a little bit of time between first grade and the early days of NPR. What was your connection to radio between that point and the point that you arrived in Washington?
So I worked at I worked my way through the University of Wisconsin in Madison at WHA, at Wisconsin Public Radio. First as an engineer, editing tape and so on, and then on air as an announcer, interviewer, reporter, that kind of thing. And then I was in the Army. I taught school up in Eagle River, Wisconsin, and I was teaching school and working summers at WHA. And they got a call from somebody I'd had as a professor at Wisconsin that wanted somebody that had experience in radio and student personnel. And I happened to have that combination because radio at SUNY Buffalo was a club, a student club. It was off the air in the summers. They'd go on the air 5 in the afternoon. And so it wasn't a proper station. Anyway, I took that opportunity because it was a wonderful chance to develop something. He gave me a lot of freedom, not much money, but we had a lot of freedom to experiment. And that's the way I used that station.
You created it. This is the station where you created This Is Radio, is that right?
Yes, which became Fresh Air. We established a storefront studio in the heart of the black community. This was during the 60s, and I was very keenly aware of the need for hearing from voices that aren't heard on radio. And so that all informed me in writing the mission statement for NPR that emphasizes the importance of celebrating difference and treating people with positive regard and to talk with many voices and many accents because that's what America's about. And I wrote that because I was trying to make the transition from educational radio to public. And the words mean something. And by public, that means everybody. And so I was trying to differentiate it from commercial radio, from educational radio, from PBS that was already on the air, and to capitalize on the unique strengths of radio as a medium, and to reflect the issues of the day, if you will.
Well, and it's interesting. We're having this conversation in 2018. I would imagine that in the mid-late 60s, there were still plenty of people already at that point who were saying the days of radio are numbered.
Yes, yes. They were. And and people would say, oh, you work in just radio? I mean, people never say that to a print journalist. Oh, you're just print? I remember there was some public broadcasting event. There were television people and radio. And it was before we were on air with NPR. And the TV guys were going through some clippings from the New York Times. They said, so, Seymour, what do you think the New York Times is going to say about you next in a year from now? I said, we're not programming for the New York Times. I was being a bit smart aleck. But I was, you know, I mean, we have just a very different orientation.
Well, and the irony is that today the New York Times is producing audio programs.
Exactly, exactly. Because this is the age of audio. When the New York Times does that, and when the New Yorker, which is kind of the preeminent print publication we think of, as the New Yorker Radio Hour, we know that radio is now, you know, elevated to a wonderful place.
Well, and I've noticed this phenomenon that I'm curious to have you reflect on because I think this is kind of what we're talking about. I mean, we're in this kind of podcast-intensive media universe today, and, you know, there are some really good ones out there, and there are some nightmarishly bad ones and plenty in between, but I can't help but think when I listen to them that this feels a lot like an earlier time in radio, that people are wanting to make them for the same reasons that you and I got into radio, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Right, and it's this wonderful storytelling. And with the volume of news that we have to deal with and you're dealing with, there's not the place for these more quiet, reflective conversations.
Where does your work in developing nations come in? What do you see as the relative importance of radio and audio in those places compared to, you know, what we kind of have the luxury of using audio for here?
Yes. So I had worked, after I had been working in public radio, I worked with the Open Society Foundation for 10 years, and they worked in Eastern Europe and Africa and Mongolia. The idea there behind their work was, look, these people have not had democracy for 70 years. They need like a Marshall Plan. And so George Soros set up foundations all over in these countries to talk about constitutions, media, law, and health, education, the basics, you know. So that's how I started my work overseas. And I went to South Africa first in 1993. This was a year before the elections, because I met with people that were interested in reforming the state broadcasting, South African Broadcasting Corporation, which was like a BBC.
Right. But at that point, it was probably just a mouthpiece for the government. Right.
And so they wanted to reform that so people could be informed about the election. And there were others interested in community radio. And interestingly enough, when the government formed their licensing authority, they only licensed community stations because they thought in the first year, because they thought they would best serve the interests of democracy, because they speak in local languages. And sometimes stations broadcast in three or more local languages. And they reflect the issues and concerns of the people, just as you do this here in Milwaukee. You're out in the community talking to people, finding out what their needs are and interests are.
How far along on the continuum were they in being able to do that?
Well, it's in terms of the production and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what we provide, in some cases, we usually always are working now with existing stations. One of our African trainers, Martha Zulu, begins her workshops by saying, "Why are we here to focus?" And it's a wonderful question. I also hear that is, why are we here on Earth? What's the purpose? What's the meaning of life? But it helps focus a station. Like, you know, are we just here to play our favorite music, or do we have a more serious purpose? So we now enrich the programming on climate change, on youth health, women's health, things like this. And we do this by always having African trainers. So we work with existing stations. We bring them together. We'll have experts talking about climate change in that country or a health issue. We give them a digital recorder and mic, and they go out and have a field exercise and then critique it so they polish their skills. Then we send them weekly bulletins on a topic, like how do you store water for drought or on malaria youth-friendly health services. And they, again, these come from there. It has the problem statement on one side and solutions and production tips on the other. So they can go out with little experience and do these.
When you do something like that, do you get a different sense of professional or self-satisfaction in what you're able to do versus, you know, shaping the various shows that you shaped in this country?
Yeah, it is. It's wonderful to see them take the initiative. It's a very different relationship. I just go over there on the first workshop sometimes. I've got a colleague that does the implementation and so on. But we have excellent African trainers, and they then go and mentor. They visit each station and mentor. But it's so satisfying to see the results where you change attitudes about talking about safe sex, for example. It's wonderful to see that impact of radio on people's lives.
No one there is saying, oh, you're just in radio.
No.
Is there a similar spirit in that kind of work when you experience a station at that stage to what the spirit was like in those kind of formative years for public radio?
There is some parallel to that. It's such a different environment, though. But they're using this wonderful imaginative creative medium. I mean, they produce little radio plays. I mean, no one's taught them that, but they do that with sound effects and everything. And that's what's so encouraging to see them taking this idea and making it their own.
When you think about where public radio was in the late 60s, mm-hmm. early 70s, and you're developing, you know, All Things Considered mm-hmm. in 1971, when you look at the soul of NPR from those days, what parts of that soul are most still in evidence in 2018? I mean, the building obviously looks mm-hmm. a lot different.
Yes. I think it really reflects some of those core values, I mean, that we had in, because I think this is what you do with Lake Effect. The editorial attitude would be that of inquiry, curiosity, concern for the quality of life, critical, problem-solving, and life-loving. So I think that's what you do with Lake Effect.
Life-loving is an underrated part of the equation, too.
Yeah. Then I said, philosophically, time is measured by the intensity of experience. Waiting for a bus and walking through an art gallery may occupy the same time duration, but not the same time experience. Listeners should feel that the time spent with NPR was among their most rewarding in media contact. National Public Radio will not regard its audience as a market or in terms of its disposable income, but as curious, complex individuals who are looking for some understanding, meaning, and joy in the human experience.
Do you remember your surroundings when you wrote those words?
I wrote that on my dining room table in Buffalo, New York. But I'd been thinking about these things for a long time and trying to make the case for radio. As we began talking about how radio was called the hidden medium, there was some folks in television tried to keep radio out of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting because we were such an embarrassment, they thought. And, of course, we take money away from television, which is more important. So this was aspirational, but I thought it was also practical. So it was a wonderful opportunity. Now, a lot of stations, I think, thought we're going to be like the big guys. It's going to sound like CBS and NBC, and it didn't. So there was the first meeting of the public radio managers, I think it was about 2 weeks after we were live. And it was kind of a hostile crowd, I must say. They said, who are these people? They wanted to sound like, you know, and I said, so we have a conversational style, you know.
They wanted to sound like Douglas Edwards.
Exactly. Right. They were very suspicious of, we were using music in the program. We had arts features, of course, because we were considering all things.
Well, just calling it All Things Considered had to have been a radical change from the kinds of names that other news programs had,
right.
You know, the CBS Evening News.
Right, right. You know, and it was hard. I mean, there were some programs where, you know, there'd be a brilliant piece and something, gosh, awful that we'd be embarrassed about because we had a very small staff gathered together, some more experienced than others. It took a while to gel as a unit. It was in beta form for a while. However, a program that was aired in October of 1972 won a Peabody Award, so we did get it together.
Well, and it is something when a document that you wrote at your dining room table in Buffalo, New York in 1970 still holds the same relevance and importance that it did 48 years ago.
Yeah, right.
Well, Bill Siemering, it has been a real honor and a delight to chat with you. Thank you so much.
I've enjoyed being with you, Mitch.
Wisconsin native Bill Siemering was on the founding board of National Public Radio. He worked at NPR, WBFO in Buffalo, Minnesota Public Radio, and WHYY in Philadelphia. Today, he's a senior fellow with the Wincote Foundation, which is also in Philadelphia.
Coming up next, a couple of weeks after the most recent British royal wedding, political essayist Art Sear considers them in a global context. We'll have that when Lake Effect Weekend continues on 89.7 WUWM.
Lake Effect Weekend continues now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. We are a couple of weeks removed from the most recent British royal wedding, the union of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. It was an event that commanded the attention of millions of people around the world.
But Lake Effect essayist Art Sear says, looking back, the nuptials should be viewed in a broader context.
The royal wedding in Britain of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle of the United States, now the Duchess of Sussex, is news seen and heard around the world. The focus of the domestic and international media on this particular family event has been pervasive pressing and, for some involved, prying. For many, this is also so unnecessary. After all, Harry's grandmother, Queen Elizabeth II, the head of state of the United Kingdom, which includes Northern Ireland as well as Britain, has little direct governing power. Nevertheless, all those posh personalities, eye-catching costumes, and courtly ceremonies generate intensely interested international audiences. The storybook dimension draws both political and apolitical people. And at least positive news is featured, which is not fake, for once. This has been a busy spring for the British royal family. Last month, the big international news flash was that Kate, Duchess of Cambridge, gave birth. The youngest, if not now newest, member of the royal family of, careful here, the United Kingdom, arrived April 23 in good form and soon afterward was named Louis Arthur Charles. The baby boy weighed 8 pounds, 7 ounces. The British government, following the June 2016 referendum vote to leave the European Union, has since been involved in a lengthy, complicated effort to do just that. Difficult negotiations have been internal as well as external, with the governing Conservative Party bitterly divided on the matter. With respect to Eurocrats in Brussels, please note the weight of the new prince is 3.8 kilograms. Earlier, shortly before the general election in May 2015, Britain's royal family announced the birth of another new baby. The arrival of Princess Charlotte Elizabeth Diana, also the child of the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, went smoothly and also was big news. As is customary, editors separated this development from any political news. Over four centuries ago, namesake Queen Elizabeth I was forcefully in charge of the British Isles. Those were brutal times, and losing a political power struggle could cost your life, sometimes quickly. Elizabeth rightly receives credit for respecting established law, the prerogatives of Parliament, and the advantages of prudent government. She stabilized politics and government following the tumultuous, unpredictable reign of her father, Henry VIII. Today, royalty and representative government have important complementary functions. As Walter Bagehot described in his 1867 book, The English Constitution, Parliament handles the practical, efficient functions of governing, while the monarchy handles the largely ceremonial, dignified functions. The important ceremonial functions address the collective emotions of the people at large about government. In the 1930s, King Edward VIII generated great controversy when he wanted to marry Wallis Simpson, who was an American. In that different earlier time, the fact that she was not British did cause concern and debate. She also had been divorced twice. In general, notoriety followed her. The vital concern, not publicly discussed by the ruling conservative government, was that Edward was sympathetic to the rulers of Nazi Germany, as well as being personally highly erratic. German officials considered him a promising strategic asset in both generating domestic support and eventually helping control Britain in a conquered Europe. Monarchist Winston Churchill supported Edward with sympathy. At the time, this reinforced the controversial Churchill's isolation in his conservative party. Finally, Edward did abdicate the throne and marry his American. After war began, successor King George VI proved an effective, valuable wartime partner of Prime Minister Churchill.
Lake Effect essayist Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business and director of the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha.
Milwaukee singer and songwriter Claudia Johnson has a new EP out. She and her band were in the studio just ahead of its release, and they performed a couple of songs from it, including this track called Money Man.
Tell me the truth. Well, is this how you had pictured your life turning out. You're living alone with all your doubt. But is there anything you're happy about? You bitch and you moan and carry on like a child. Won't be happy till you own fellow man's one desire. Money man, how do you sleep? Oh, you'll bring back some more than any man could need. Money man, don't you feel alone? 'Cause money man, you're reaping what you sow. Could you have foreseen how far you'd go and the potential for your brand to greed? In your quest to have the most, you overlooked the basic rules of truth and honesty. You cheat and you lie and do it all with a smile. Not a thought for who or why, just financially worthwhile. Money man, how do you sleep? Oh, your greenbacks more than any man could need. Money man, don't you feel alone? 'Cause money man, you reaping what you sow.
Milwaukee musician Claudia Johnson and her band performing Money Man off their new EP, Nothing But Time. You can hear the full interview at WUWM.com.
We'll take another break, and then Radio Chipstone talks with Madison-based metalsmith Joseph Pine. You're listening to Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee's NPR. We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Joseph Pine is completely comfortable going public about his relationship with metal. The Madison-based metalsmith says his work is a conversation with the material. It's intimate and seductive.
However, the relationship isn't necessarily monogamous. In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Pine, who recently graduated with his MFA from UW-Madison, tells contributor Jennifer Fields that the relationship is purposely open. He wants the viewer to see and feel all the private conversations he has with the work.
I'm hoping that they can see a point in the making that normally only a metalsmith gets to see. Only metalsmiths get to see the raw hammer marks, the rough forming, the shape beginning to emerge. And so in my work, I like to freeze that and to just completely allow it to be visible for anyone to see. Whether or not they understand how it got there, I want them to be able to feel it.
So in feeling that and talking about the metal being seductive, when I think about things that are seductive, it becomes a two-way street. It's something that draws me in, but then I also get something from it in return. Not always what I want, but something. So Joe, talk to me about, like, how does metal satisfy that sort of relationship with you, because it seems to be something that's romantic. It seems to be a relationship that's intimate.
It is very intimate. I'm getting something from the metal as much as it's getting something from me. I like to think of my work as a conversation. I have my talking points, and sometimes it tells me when to shut up.
In relationships, one of the things that makes them work are boundaries. How do you, if metal is something that's so intriguing for you, something that pulls you in on this intimate level, what are your boundaries? And how do you set those? What would that even look like? Or do you have boundaries? Maybe you don't.
I don't know that we do. I think that the relationship can be somewhat argumentative at times, and that we get into some fights, but ultimately, the metal almost always comes out on top. In a lot of ways, I'm a servant to the metal rather than the other way around.
So then when you see a piece of metal, or when you see, yeah, when you see metal, in whatever form it takes, is it something that you look at it and it tells you what it wants to be, or do you impose your will on the metal?
I cannot impose my will on the metal. It imposes its will on me. It tells me what it wants to be. As I'm working it, as I'm hammering it, even though I may have an idea in mind, it does what it wants to do in the end. And that's something that maybe a lot of metalsmiths won't share or don't feel, but it's something that I feel very strongly.
So then when do you cut the conversation off? Is it the piece appears to be finished, or are you not getting any more input? Has the metal said all it has to say and that's when it's over? Or do you look at something and go, that's done?
There's a moment when I'm working where I look at the piece that I'm making and I have a little giggle and I feel a little warmth in my belly and I go, you're finished, you're ready. And you can do this, go out into the world and tell people your story.
So let's look at some of your pieces and let's talk about the story. One of the things I really, really, really like is the repair series. And you picked the one that I really wanted to talk about. So first of all, describe the project, Joe, the repair series, and talk to me about why you picked this particular thing to repair.
The repair series was really born from an interest in contemporary material culture and the way that we, as Americans or as people, don't necessarily interact with objects with the same level of tacit knowledge or familiarity as people may have in the past. And I know that that sounds a bit nostalgic, but it's something that I found really interesting. A lot of things, as soon as they were broken, get thrown in the garbage.
And one of the things you've chosen is this press pot, this French press pot. And coffee is such a ritualized thing. It's interesting to me to think about that as a disposable object. You broke and throw it away. And then something that you chose to revive.
Well, the moment I started working with what was essentially garbage and sewing things back together and stitching them with gold staples, the pieces found me. People were bringing in their garbage to my studio. And so this French press was actually something that Jeffrey Clancy, my professor, brought in, and he jokingly said, here, go ahead and fix that as a challenge. And so I did. I made a brass carafe for it, and it's a fully functional French press with a cheap plastic top and a cheap plastic handle and a handmade carafe, and I love it for that. It's whimsical. It's fun.
So, Joe, as we stand here and we look, I see metal toothpicks. I see what look like, I'm not sure if they're dull implements of destruction or repurposed broken fondue set. What's going on with these tiny little implements that look like they could be dangerous?
So those pieces were the beginning of me showing the process. And what you're actually seeing in the handle is a raw ingot that was poured from sterling silver. And I left that ingot handle raw, and then just made some really rough butter knife forms for the edges so that they're totally potentially useful, but you can see exactly how they were made.
So tell me, Joe, you have this relationship with the metal. Are there times when you two just don't get along? Have you ever been frustrated by the process, frustrated by the metal, and where does that take you?
I think the moments of frustration are fewer and more far between the more I work. The aesthetic that I'm taking on now, the raw, the loose, it's really allowed for that frustration to just pass on because I can say, well, the metal cracked. It told me it was going to crack. I guess I'd better listen.
So then your frustration, you think, before came from not listening to the metal, was not understanding the process.
I think so, yes. I think not listening, not feeling what the metal was doing to my arms, what sounds it was making at the anvil, those were where the mistakes were coming in. I was being a little bit too arrogant, and I wasn't giving the metal its due respect.
Has the metal taught you anything that you take from it into your life outside of the studio? What have you learned from the metal that you can just use in your everyday life?
I think it's to let go of the little imperfections, because what I as a metalsmith might see in a spoon as an imperfection, someone else finds as a mark of beauty. And the same thing is true of myself. The things that I dislike about myself and that I think are glaring, someone else might find beautiful.
Who's your audience for your work?
Anyone who has ever used a spoon. I say it in jest, but really, the work right now is all about using the language of a spoon to teach people about what metal is, what it does, and how it can be manipulated. And so the spoon is just an access point. It's not necessarily a critical part of the dialogue for the work, but it's something that allows someone to go, hey, that looks familiar, and to explore and to reach and deep down kind of think and experience an object both by handling it physically and by looking and questioning it. I think it's really important that people get a sense of the weight of the movement and really just to think critically about the objects that they're handling every day.
How important is it to you for people to handle your work?
I think it's critical. My work is made while I'm touching it, while I'm handling it. I'm feeling things. I'm experiencing them with my hands. And I think interacting with artwork and with the world with your hands is important. One of the pieces that I got out for you, actually, is technically an art piece. It's a pair of plain old school orange-handled scissors that someone broke part of the handle off of. And so I replaced a portion of the handle with cherry wood and then fastened it to the handle with 18 karat gold staples. A lot of people might look at this piece and go, that is a work of art. These are my everyday scissors. If I need to cut a piece of paper, these are the best scissors for the job. And I think that using art and using decorative objects is critical. It is not only about aesthetic. Even though aesthetic might be there, these objects are meant to be used.
Material culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
This week, Jennifer spoke with metalsmith Joseph Pine, a recent graduate from UW-Madison's MFA program in fine art.
We'll take one last break and then have our storytelling series Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend returns right after this on Milwaukee's NPR.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to Ex Fabula!
True personal story.
Ex Fabula!
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And that, of course, means it's time for Ex Fabula Radio on Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Rachel Owens, joined by Ex Fabula's Carolina Mulvey-Videla. Hope I didn't butcher your name too much. Welcome. This is your first time with us.
Yeah, nice to be here.
And actually, this week, you're one of our storytellers as well. So
yeah,
we'll get to that in a minute. But first, let's talk about the theme. So this week's theme is immigration. That's one that seems to grow only ever more important, both here in the U.S. and across the globe.
Yeah, it's been prevalent in media especially, and I've noticed that there's been a lot of hostility in policy and everything, so it is definitely something we need to start talking about a little bit more.
What prompted you to tell your story?
I was encouraged by my staff last year to tell a story at the Whiteness and Privilege Fellowship event at the Workshop Architects as part of our fellowship program, and so I took a chance to share a pretty personal story there.
Yeah, it's very powerful, as people will hear. And after the story, we can mention an upcoming event that ties directly into this theme as well. But first, let's just go ahead and hear your story.
All right. So I sort of want to set the scene. So it was back in August, a Saturday in August, where I was going into work, where I was a waitress. It was a restaurant on Brady Street that I worked at for a couple years. So it was the day after a friend's funeral, and so I wasn't exactly, if you can imagine, in the best mood. And I go in, and I'm sort of already really upset. And I am in the back, taking my time for silence. And I come out, and I see my coworker. And this is someone that I've known for probably 4 years, who I've told all of my family history, myself, everything about myself. So he looks me straight in the eye, and he says, "Carolina, aren't you excited for Donald Trump to be president so you'll get deported?" I looked at him and I said, really, all I said was, "I really hope you're having a better day." So I left. And I'd end up not working the rest of my shift that day. If you can imagine, I was pretty upset with everything. And so I really had to sort of take a step back and wonder why I was kind of taken back by this comment that he made me, realizing that it was sort of the first moment in my life where my ethnicity was so aggressively commented to me in such an aggressive way. And so I want to give a little backstory. I am from Chile, and so I'm from a really small village in Chile, actually. And so when we immigrated here in 1996, it was me and my mom, my dad, my siblings, who are much more brown than me. And I had grown up really experiencing secondhand a lot of injustice, a lot of micro and macro aggressions, really macro, all from my older brother getting detained at TSP after 9/11 to an interviewer at my sister's Java interview saying, "I'm really surprised you have a bachelor's degree." And so I grew up witnessing all this, and then I sort of took a step back, hid behind the fact that I could just pass as white, that I could just go to school and fit in, because that's what I so desperately wanted to do. And so I didn't really acknowledge the fact that while I was hiding behind my whiteness, I was also hiding my culture and my history and my family along with it. And so when I would view these injustices, I was more of a bystander than someone directly affected. And so I had a conversation with a friend of mine the other day who immigrated here from Mexico with his mom. He's been living here since he was 9 years old, and so he's 30 now, and he grew up in Green Bay. And he was talking to me about his experience immigrating here, the difficulty, him and his mom always trying to make a better life for them, and always saying every year, it's going to get better, every year it's gonna get better, it's gonna keep getting better. And it didn't for them. And so I'm listening to him tell me this story, and I'm sort of thinking, wow, I sound a lot like your mom. Because every time I talk to my mother about, you know, all of these different things, I seem to sound like a broken record too, where I say, yeah, mom, it'll get better. Every year will get better, it's fine. Or when I talk to my sister, who does a lot of work with social justice and immigration, we're always kind of taken back by the fact that, you know, it's not getting better. And so when I am confronted with someone like my coworker and the hatred that he spewed at me at that moment and the power that he had over me, it really made me reflect on the fact that things aren't getting better as often as we would like to believe so.
So that was a story that I told at the Whiteness and Privilege Fellowship event last year at Workshop Architects, part of our fellowship program.
Yeah, that was powerful. I mean, it's so disenchanting to hear that even though you think things are changing or they should be changing, they're really not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that story. And along those lines, the theme for today is immigration, and you have an upcoming story slam next week, I believe.
Yeah, we have an event on Monday, June 4th at Peddler's Hall in Bayview. We partnered with the Bayview Historical Society to bring about storytellers to talk about immigration to Bayview specifically and how people's families immigrated there. And that's going to be from 6:30 to 8:30.
Okay, wonderful. A lot of us thought that the season was completely over. It's nice to know there's one more chance
this
to get in.
This is our last event.
All right, awesome. Okay, so now we'll just jump right into the second story. And this is a long and powerful story as well, told by Brian Chu. However, we're only going to have time to air the first half of it, but listeners will be able to hear the full story on our website, wuwm.com. So anything you want to say about this story before we head in?
Yeah, you really don't want to miss this full story. It's really, really, really powerful. I had the pleasure of hearing it at a curated event that we did last year as well. And Brian's just such an amazing storyteller and such an amazing organizer and person that you definitely don't want to miss it.
All right, here we go.
So it was 1983. I was 10 years old. I was living in Taiwan. My mom was taking my brother and me on a two-week tour of the United States. And my dad was already in the United States on business. And he would meet us at the tour and join us at the tour. So I've been reading the travel brochure, and it was very exciting. It was awesome. You know, the tour, it was like 3 days in Hawaii, and then San Francisco and Yosemite, Las Vegas and LA, which of course meant Disneyland. So it was also my first time outside of Taiwan, and also my first time on the airplane. So the tour group from Taiwan booked up most of that Continental Airlines flight. So during the flight, the kids started running around in packs around the airplane. You know, the only thing I knew how to say in English back then was one soda, because, you know, it gets you one free soda. So the plane landed in Honolulu. We checked into the hotel. We unpacked our bags. My mom sat me and my brother down and said, by the way, we're staying in the United States, you know, for good. So my life flashed in front of my eyes, all 10 years of it. and I said, how is this happening? You know, what about my friends? What about this girl I liked? What about my stuff? Where's all my stuff? And my brother, who is 1 year older but infinitely wiser, rolled his eyes and said, how can you not see this coming? My parents packed everything. They sold the house. They sold the car. I said, I thought international travel was really, really expensive. So at the end of the tour, my dad showed up in a gigantic American car, the Pontiac Phoenix, and drove us to our new home. Apparently, he's been preparing for our arrival. He's gotten us an apartment, he bought a restaurant with our savings, and he fixed up our immigration paperwork. So I guess this is where we're going to grow up, you know, in South County, San Diego, 5 miles north of the Mexican border. Now, being right next to the border, in a border town, when I started school, nobody in school spoke my native language, and I was constantly trying to figure out if I was learning English or Espanol. Some of the kids were undocumented from Mexico. Two of them, Elias and Stefano, they became my best friends. And I feel like I'm privileged with this illegal immigration status, that it's my duty to stand up for them, to make sure nobody picks on them. Every time the other kids would call them wetback, I would step up and people would back off because everybody thought that I knew karate. So that's where I grew up. We spoke Spanglish. We ate machaca with eggs for breakfast. We ate menudo on Saturdays. At night, I would listen to radio coming from the other side of the border. Playing like corrido or ranchera music, you know, la música mexicana. You know it's 11 o'clock when the station identification comes on. And then I would just stop everything I'm doing and I repeat after the radio. Estéreo, 107.9, 9, 9. See, that was my hometown now. I would defend it with my karate. I would defend it with everything I got. So I was in high school when the Berlin Wall fell. Nelson Mandela was taking down apartheid in South Africa. People were everywhere standing up for the rights, and I was swept up. For my college application, I wrote an essay about how, if accepted into UC San Diego, I was going to use my education. I was going to dedicate my life to standing up for justice and democracy and all that good stuff. And I sent in that essay. I was really proud of myself. That night, when my parents came home from the restaurant, couldn't wait to tell them, and then I just saw blood drain from their faces. At first, we argued about being politically active. I said, hey, you did it in Taiwan, why couldn't I do it here? So they sat me down again, and they said, yeah, you're actually an illegal immigrant. apparently my parents have screwed up the immigration paperwork a few years back. They just didn't bother to tell me. So I got that familiar feeling of a kind of shock and betrayal, and the nagging feeling that my brother probably figured this out already.
And that was the first half of Brian Chu's story about immigration. You can find the second half as well on our website, wuwm.com. And you're going to want to listen to the full story because that story continues to go in unexpected directions. And as we heard, he's really a great storyteller, a very dynamic presence on stage.
Yeah, Brian was part of the fellowship the year prior to mine, and so he has been crafting this one specific story for a really long time. And I really had the privilege of hearing his story at a curated event that we did last year, and Brian's just a really great, dynamic, powerful, passionate person and storyteller.
And that really seems to get into the complexities of immigration as well.
Exactly.
And why there is so much to talk about.
Yeah, it's very nuanced, very messy.
And for folks wishing to see some more live storytelling, looks like they're in luck. So, Carolina, where can listeners check that out?
We have our events at Bayview at Puddler's Hall on June 4th. It's going to be from 6:30 to 8:30. The theme is Immigration to Bayview, partnering with the Bayview Historical Society.
All right. And we'll find more details at wuwm.com as well as xfabula.org. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Carolina, and for sharing your story, of course.
Thank you.
All right. Check you next week.
X Fabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up another edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned now for All Things Considered. It's coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.